Our faith, Unitarian Universalism, has been and is a transforming force for justice. We have a rich history of Unitarians and Universalists who transformed our country. Our forebears helped heal Civil War soldiers and abolish slavery. They insisted upon the acceptance of conscientious objectors and women as ordained ministers. They organized for women's rights, including the vote. They ran schools for children and youth, revolutionizing how they were taught, what they were taught, and even how they were valued in society. Their justice work took different, sometimes surprising forms. Unitarian Broadway lyricist Oscar Hammerstein wrote, "You've got to be carefully taught." It's a song from Rodgers and Hammerstein's 1949 musical, South Pacific. The words go like this. I won't sing them. "You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed into your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught." So that little ditty received widespread criticism, judged by some to be too controversial or downright inappropriate for a musical stage. One legislator in Georgia said that a song justifying interracial marriage was implicitly a threat to the American way of life. Lawmakers in that state introduced a bill, in fact, outlining entertainment containing an underlying philosophy inspired by Moscow. You have to remember the times. Oscar Hammerstein actually wrote several songs with justice-making lyrics just like that one. He was committed to transformation in his way. Acting out of our faith, not only can we transform our communities and the world, but our faith can also transform us. Let me tell you a story about another one of our forebears. Born in 1778, a college roommate of William Ellery Channing, Unitarian Reverend Dr. Joseph Tuckerman was a parish minister for 25 years in Chelsea, Massachusetts. But in 1826, at the age of 48, he left Chelsea to start a ministry at large in Boston. At first, when he started his ministry, Reverend Tuckerman thought the poor were people very different from himself and from others of polite society. He thought, as did so many other Unitarians of that time, that the poor were deviant and had questionable morals. It was vice that made them poor. Reverend Tuckerman believed that this was the natural world order, that there would always be poor people. One influential local observer called most poor who were not old, infants, sick, or physically disabled as loafers. So Reverend Tuckerman expected his work to assist the poor in attaining physical needs and to help them find God, but not necessarily to lift them out of poverty. But his work with them began to work on him. He began to visit the homes of the poor, hanging out with them, learning about their lives, and he called these friendly visits. So he would just drop by, meeting and talking with them. He slowly learned about them and about the tenor of their lives. And what Joseph Tuckerman discovered through these face-to-face encounters with the poor is that they were like everyone else. Some were virtuous and some were not. And as his work continued, Tuckerman grew to believe that most poor were in situations in which they were not to blame for their own poverty. Drawing from his experiences of the poor, he challenged traditional notions of them. In 1830, he wrote an essay in which he argued that the structural problems of the economic system were more significant than the moral ignorance of the poor in causing poverty. His language would work very well in the Occupy movement. Tuckerman was not the only Unitarian minister in Boston to work amongst the poor, but he led the way. As other Unitarian ministers served Boston's poor, many of them also began to be transformed, and they reversed their belief regarding the morality and willingness of the poor to work. Their face-to-face encounters changed their perceptions. Eventually, Reverend Tuckerman cast aside belief in the prevailing Unitarian attitude that poverty and its effects were inevitable. So through his ministry, he came to believe that no matter the circumstances of a person's life, his nature and the nature of all others was essentially the same. So Hugh said, "My first thought in approaching him is not, how may I give him the greatest immediate relief, but who are they? I have not a capacity of mind or heart, of knowledge or virtue, which is not an essential part of their nature also." Reverend Tuckerman started churches for the poor and Sunday schools all throughout Boston, and by 1836 had more than 700 children attending. William Ellery Channing wrote this about his former roommate. "He had a genius for the kind of work he undertook in Boston. He loved the poor, put himself on an equality with them, and devoted to them all his thought and energy. The methods of the Associated Charities were thought out by him and put into practice before they were adopted elsewhere. Believing that the chief purpose of his work was to develop manhood and not to minister to material needs, he carried on his work as a part of the administration of a simple and genuine religion." So Reverend Tuckerman's story reveals that his religion led him to work in which he transformed his faith, our faith. And following his faith, he was then transformed himself. But as Reverend Tuckerman's story reveals, for all the work our forebears did on fostering justice and equity, in deepening understanding of what our faith calls us to do, we must also realize that there are times when we fell short. Remember that Reverend Tuckerman originally thought poor people radically different from himself. Colleagues turned their backs on a Unitarian minister who advocated for total nonviolence during World War I. In the early and mid-20th century, one of our theological schools did not support men of color becoming Unitarian or Universalist ministers. In the mid-1800s, a Unitarian president signed into law legislation supported by a Unitarian senator, which made it easier for Southern slaveholders to control their lands. Physician Benjamin Rush was a founding member of the Pennsylvania Society for the Abolition of Slavery. And yet in 1792, he presented a paper before the American Philosophical Society in which he argued that the color and figure of blacks was caused by leprosy. I was surprised to learn that also. If Reverend Tuckerman had never worked with the poor, it is unlikely that he would have ever changed his idea about poor people. So much of the rich narrative we know about past Unitarians and Universalists comes from letters they wrote, sometimes in response to something they read, sometimes in response to a public speech they heard. For instance, Benjamin Rush wrote a letter to an English minister, Dr. Price, in 1787. He begins, "Accept my thanks for the copy of your sermons by Dr. White. I have read them with great pleasure. I have even done more. I have transcribed part of one of them for the benefit of a pious and accomplished female correspondent in a neighboring state." Rush then goes on to share his thoughts on the sermons, agreeing with some points, but chastising Dr. Price for his timidity in areas having to do with the equality of all people. To provide a copy of intellectual works to a woman in Benjamin Rush's day would have been somewhat unusual, as women were struggling to be seen as having any intellect at all at that point. Rush's small action illustrated his belief in his connection to the whole human race and the value of all. Like Reverend Tuckerman, Benjamin Rush provides us with another example of engagement with his faith. He spent time deepening his faith by reading widely, as well as putting into practice his belief in justice. Deepening our faith means that we learn about our rich past. We hold on to what was right and just and good, and realize that sometimes we fall short. Last Friday, I went to a presentation on a topic that has troubled me for many years, and that's human trafficking. I learned about Eastern European women being trafficked some 10 years ago, trafficked to countries like Greece and Italy, and I donated to a few organizations who I thought were trying to make a difference. Modern-day slavery, however, only came to my attention a year or so ago when our youth group wanted to find out more about it, so I went along with them to an organization in Oakland. I was truly appalled when I found out that women are being brought to the United States, who are then all but locked up in homes as domestic help, their passports taken away, working all hours, never having a day off, often not having a room of their own, and sometimes sexually preyed upon by the males in that household. They come from all sorts of countries. They are wooed here with the promise of good domestic jobs. I am truly appalled that the busboy at any given restaurant that I eat in might be locked in at night, denied his freedom. Modern-day slavery is men and women, boys and girls. I don't know what became of Melinda, but clearly her life in prostitution could have started as one of the girls I've heard about, one of the local Oakland girls I've heard about, no more than 11 or 12, forced to have sex in order to eat and to have a place to sleep. It turns out that some of our children are being trafficked in our country, so they're taken from, let's say, Oakland down to a city in Southern California. So they're taken away from any opportunity that they might have of escaping by going to someone that they know. So a few months ago, I gave a sermon on some of the freedom and justice songs in our hymnal. So I spent time contemplating them, reading them, listening to them, humming them, finding out where they came from. And it just hit me. The juxtaposition of those hymns and the lives of some 30 million modern-day slaves. Through taking time to contemplate my faith, which is sometimes hard to do when you're a student, believe it or not, I have been transformed, and I have begun to act. I've just discovered, for example, that our Justice GA in Phoenix in June, there is a proposed congregational study action issue on ending slavery. It will be discussed, and perhaps it will become one of the issues that we decide to delve into. I have also discovered that there are people who call themselves modern-day UU abolitionists. So I say, count me in. We are also called to engage with the authors of today, like Gary Smith, like our own Unitarian Universalist authors, who are thinking and writing about Unitarian Universalism and social justice. I encourage you to read their works, to take time to contemplate what they are saying, to see how they might fit in with your own beliefs. And because we're in the internet age, you don't have to be like Benjamin Rush and write a letter that will get there 3 months later. You can go on and see if they have a blog and leave a post. You can tweet. You can Facebook. I know that these authors would welcome your engagement and your comments, and that all of us can enrich our faith by this interchange. Many of our hands are busy providing direct aid to those in our community. We might cook for the homeless, one of the things that I love to do, sort food at the food bank, make calls for marriage equality, participate in an Occupy General Assembly or a rally, and more. We all know there is so much to be done, but we need to engage our hearts and engage our minds together. In effect, it means that we engage in our social justice activities with full intentionality, with our whole selves. As Reverend Peter Morales said yesterday in his breakfast address to the PCD District Assembly, which is where Reverend Christopher is, he said, it means taking ourselves seriously as a religion, which does not mean not having any fun. Our principles and sacred sources can guide us in this. Most of us are quite familiar with our first and last principle. We might say they are the slices of bread that keep our sandwich together. But some of the equally as tasty bits are in between, like our second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We've got lots of principles between the inherent web and the interconnection of everyone. Go deep, go beyond our first and last principles. Peel away those slices of bread and expose the tasty goodness in between. Draw on our many sacred sources as guidance. Read, contemplate, continue with your justice work. Read some more, contemplate some more. We have so many sacred sources that sometimes I think we forget to actually take time to look at them. Of course, opening our minds will not get us very far if we don't let our hearts crack open, as Gary Smith talked about. Our open hearts act as a conduit from the injustice that is the world now to the justice that we want in the world. Remember that Reverend Tuckerman's heart was already engaged when he decided to work with the poor, but he didn't constrain his love. Rather, he let himself deepen his contacts. Do you think about how you might be connected to that homeless person that you feed? I want to read you another passage from Gary Smith. Among the poor, the church learns to be indignant at the sight of discarded human beings. And it is taught to passionately challenge systems and structures that produce such human beings. It is one thing to practice charity, to give a poor person some bread, or to treat the same person with respect. It is quite another thing to challenge a system in which people are hungry, in which some can be so rich and many so poor. As Cardinal Sin of the Philippines once said, love without justice is baloney. The Gospels and the documents of the church speak directly to the notion of solidarity with the poor. Books have been written on it. Sermons have been preached on it. But the poor themselves instruct me in the practical realities of this notion. I find out about them by entering their world. Solidarity with them means knowing them, their sights and smells and sounds, their hopes and deprivations. The poor teach me that serving them is not just some sort of imperative. Rather, it is in serving them that I can discover, like the church, what is best in my own heart. My social justice work started when I worked in a refugee camp. I was one who was very sheltered, and it was the biggest shock. But it has led me to stand here in front of you on this path toward ministry because of that experience, that face-to-face experience, cracked my heart open. Perhaps you came to Unitarian Universalism as a baby or a child and don't really remember any other religion. Or perhaps you arrived here as a teen trying to get someplace where your parents were not. Or maybe you were an adult searching for spiritual sustenance within a supportive community. searching for a religion that spoke to the particularities of your intellect and of your heart. The way we engage with social justice at a deep, personal level will be unique. By your social justice work, however, you will transform Unitarian Universalism. And we need you to keep your faith relevant and to spread the light of love. But it's only fair that I warn you that you, in turn, when you are engaged with your faith, that your faith will transform you. Bless you all. Please love one another, and please open your heart to the stranger. So may it be. Please rise, embody your spirit, to sing hymn number 170, Gentle, Angry People.